Take a network break. Sit back and meditate on the perfect virtual donut while the packet pushers mediate this week's tech news. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. Today's show is sponsored in part by ExtraHop, the leader in real-time IT analytics. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. Tweet at ExtraHop and mention packet pushers to get a free t-shirt. And to learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself, visit extrahop.com/demo. This episode is also sponsored by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. Sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers to monitor 3 locations for free and choose a ThousandEyes t-shirt. To the news, Arista has announced the VEOS router. This is a virtualized instance of its network OS. It offers a full routing stack, and you can run it in the public cloud.
Yeah, so not surprising. At least we got some product news for a change, which is nice.
Yeah.
So the VEOS router looks fundamentally to me like they took the EOS operating system and said, well, it's just Linux, so we'll take the hardware out of it, call it a router, and slap it into the public cloud. Boom. All job done. Guts go home. Is that what you thought?
That is what I thought. It's supposed to be coming out in the Q4, and they're going to initially put it on the AWS and Azure marketplaces, and it's an actual full routing stack. If you don't like the way Amazon or Azure does networking, you can choose to use EOS instead. And I think the goal here is that you can marry this up with CloudVision, which is their management and orchestration platform. You get to run your data center and your cloud networking exactly the same way, use the same tools, same processes, collect all the same information. So it's about ease of operation, standardization of operation.
So to me, this feels a bit like if your only tool's a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
There is some of that here. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So I don't want to run this down. I think this is an excellent. So let me just say the good things first. This is an excellent strategic move. What is clear, and I did a YouTube video on this where, you know, when we were at VMworld, 96% of enterprises say they will be in the public cloud by 2018 in some form or another. Now, how much will be in the cloud? Answer, not much, less than 6%. According to the VMworld survey that they published, right? But the point is that if people do actually move to the public cloud, and that yet remains to be seen substantially in the enterprise, then you better start putting something in there if you want to be ready in case that transition happens, right? So we've seen Cisco rush off and start slapping the word cloud and subscriptions and stuff all over the top of their products.
And we're going to talk about that more next, but yes.
Yeah, right, you know. You can argue whether this is actually value-adding or whether whatever it is, but, you know, customers are buying it, so who knows. So this looks like, you know, the big thing that Arista's got is its EOS operating system. It is Linux. They choose to run it on merchant silicon. They've done a good job of making the EOS operating system better than Cisco, or more Cisco than Cisco, or certainly a better quality from Cisco. The stories that I've heard from people who own Arista is at least it works is a common refrain. Right. So code stability and reliability actually accounts for a lot. So if you're running a data center and you think you want to have the same routing, you know, your IPsec, some sort of MPLS, some sort of segment routing, some sort of overlay capabilities, and you want to keep using EOS because that's what your institution's using and integrates with Arista's management platform called CloudVision, then this is a way for you to put the road into the cloud that might suit what you want, especially if you're going to go into Equinix and use their direct or private bandwidth into the cloud. Make sense?
It does make sense, yes.
So, okay, so if you're a certain type of customer with a very niche use case, you have got a problem. But what it sort of forgets is what VMware's doing with NSX Cloud or what Cisco's doing with ACI in terms of its hybrid cloud and actually putting virtual switches into the instances themselves so that you can actually network directly from inside of the instance, like the EC2 instance, or what any one of a number of other players have done to say, you know, just putting a router in the cloud does not put a network in the cloud, I don't think. I think it's a step, but it's certainly not actually a cloud strategy yet.
We both got briefed by Arista on this, and this is one of the things you brought up. Like, so what do I do with this? Are we talking about moving workloads? Are we talking about cloud bursting? Are we talking about something else? And they're like, not yet. This is our toehold in the cloud. Maybe we'll have other things to bring, but right now it's just about standard operations. It reminded me, talking about VMware, about the fact that VMware in some cases has an advantage because they've got more of that stack that actually runs your workload, including with NSX, some networking capabilities. So having that bridge into the cloud that like they're doing with their AWS announcement makes a lot of sense. Arista's got less. It's just the network part of that stack, which is important, but it still leaves them, I think, a little bit lacking.
Yeah, feels like put toe in the water.
Yes.
And let's see, you know, let's start iterating with our customers and see if we can work out what they actually want, which I think is, you know, not where a company should be. But then again, you know, they're growing so hard in the hardware space and been fighting the legal suits with Cisco and getting the switches and building new switches. There's only so much they can cover. So maybe this is all they can manage at this particular point in the life cycle of the company. They're not actually that big compared to other companies, right?
That's right. They are. They're very small compared to some other companies. And it also occurred to me that I thought, is this going to help Arista attract new customers? I don't think necessarily so. I think it's more about protecting the customers they have, losing them to a cloud network.
I could imagine that if you had a cloud, you were buying direct connect bandwidth into AWS or Azure, whatever, you know, they have their own proprietary names for them, you know, a private MPLS service via Equinix, and you'd want to put an EOS router at each end of that because, well, because you probably don't even know why you're doing it, to be honest, but you do. And and so this is that solution for those people. They can now drop those instances in and route through them in
yes,
the thing.
That's right.
This idea, though, of you not using public cloud resources doesn't make sense in a lot of cases. If you want to pave over a public cloud and make it look like your existing data center, that's going to cost you a lot of money and you're going to lose a lot of performance because now everything has to run over Amazon's network and then through these instances. So there are definite challenges with this. The other part about this is I believe the private connections to these clouds is actually just a reaction to customers being stupid. You shouldn't use private bandwidth into the cloud. You should be using internet and you should have some sort of SD-WAN appliance in the front. If you're going to run, you know, some sort of AMI or, you know, Azure image and use that as your front end, like as a router, then why don't you just deploy an SD-WAN appliance from one of the SD-WAN and then you get all the advantages of an SD-WAN. You get multiple carrier, you get to use the internet, you get acceleration, you get cloud-based monitoring, you get visibility. Those sorts of things are far in excess of Arista's cloud vision as it sits today, and sure, they're going to be iterating over in the future. So I think this is a first step for Arista to put its foot in the cloud, but I think if you're going to be in the cloud, you probably want to be looking at an SD-WAN provider, not at Arista.
I would say in the general case, I agree with you about using public internet as opposed to one of this, like an Equinix or some other direct connect into one of these cloud services. But I could also see where there are use cases where performance is very key that you want to get squeeze as much out of it as you can. And so you're going to take one of these options from an Equinix that actually has close, deep connections right into the cloud providers.
Yeah. I mean, keep in mind, you've got to pay for Arista for using its VEOS, VEOS instance, and then you've got to pay for the burn on the CPU of a VM.
Yep.
And then you also have to pay for the bandwidth as well.
Well, as you've mentioned, it seems that enterprise IT is not opposed to actually spending money. So they're willing to burn.
Where they do get upset is when they get unexpected costs.
Yes.
So if you put this in, you think, I've got my VEOS, I've got my, and I have my, and then all of a sudden something unexpected, like the cost of the bandwidth or the burn on the CPU, the instance hour charges from AWS or something like that gets beyond a certain amount. And all of a sudden you're looking at a bill going, wow, that's an unhappy day.
That's right. Unexpected costs are unhappy.
So good announcement, but obvious, not innovation, not disruption, not anything. And at this point in time, I would suggest you look at SD-WAN, because what you really want isn't just to connect your data center to the cloud. You actually want to connect your WAN to the cloud. You need to do both, in my opinion. Think of the whole vision. Don't just think of, I've got a data center problem, I'll solve that with this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking of cloud, Cisco is announcing a service to let customers manage their UCS servers and their HyperFlex hyperconverged systems from the cloud. It's called Intersight, and it's going to be available in the fourth quarter of this year.
So I think we talked about this a couple of weeks back. We called it Project Starship.
I think there's a bigger Cisco initiative called Project Starship, and then Intersight is sitting underneath this.
I got an idea. This is Project Starship, and this is the official name, is called Intersight. I was watching some Tech Field Day videos, and basically what they've done is, of the HyperFlex converged system stack that Cisco's now selling and competing against all of its partners, which is quite entertaining. Keep in mind that the acquisition of a storage company, Springpath, means that Cisco now produces UCS hyperconverged systems directly competing with NetApp and all the other people.
Right.
So what they've done now is said, we can give you cloud-based management. So we can make those HyperFlex converged systems look like Meraki.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you go up there, you click on the GUI, and then all of a sudden all of your HyperFlex is managed from the cloud, and you get the advantage of, you know, whether you perceive that as an advantage or not is yet to be seen. But it's a very confusing market, because now you've got HyperFlex, which has multiple moving parts. You've got the storage and you've got the compute, and then you've got the VMs. So I think that's how HyperFlex runs KVM. And then you've got the UCS manager. Then you've got the UCS director, which is the software administration on top of that. And now you have Intersight, which moves all of that into the cloud. And the way that Cisco, I think, is licensing is that each one of those pieces needs to be licensed individually. So it's going to be a very expensive buying process because you have to establish which licenses you need to buy, right? So you have to buy HyperFlex and UCS and these features in the UCS and these features on the hard drives and, you know, all of the silliness that Cisco goes on with SKUs. And then once you finish that part, just for the hardware, then you've got to deal with all the software, and then you've got to deal with the Cisco One, and then you've got to put it in the cloud. And each one of these business units wants a slice. So when I read the documentation on this, I came away like, wow, this is really going to be hard to buy. And you're going to spend a lot of time in a spreadsheet deciding what to buy, I think. And that's probably not a good use of your time.
I mean, if that's the way it's actually working out, then that's the opposite of the Meraki model, as much as Cisco may be trying to emulate that. It's complicated instead of simplifying.
Yes, but what it does do is it means that Cisco gets to spend time with customers. And the more time you can spend in front of a customer, the more you can make sure that they buy the solution that you offer them. If you make it too easy for them to buy, they walk away or they might go to somebody else, right? If you can engage, suck up all of their time in meetings and talking about your solution, then that solution is the one that you'll end up buying because you'll have committed so much resources to buying that product that you'll just buy it out of exhaustion in the end.
I can see how that could be a strategy. I think that strategy may have worked 10 years ago. It's not the way things are done now, or at least shouldn't be. And it's not going to work out for Cisco in the long term if that's the strategy they're clinging to.
I think it works for now. I don't think it'll work into the near future. Now, the good part about this is that resellers should be getting pretty excited about this because if they can convince a customer to buy this, they can now remotely manage and operate these HyperFlex systems. And that means less on-site time for engineers or not having to remotely access customer after customer after customer. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Although Cisco also said you can use the service from Cisco, that you can get it through a reseller or a partner, but you can also use it from Cisco. So again, Cisco competing with its own resellers and VARs.
Yeah, well, I think Cisco's got the cloud solution. Resellers would sell the customers all of the stuff and the licenses and the SKUs. But if you're a reseller engineer and you want to support your customer or offer them a service contract around the HyperFlex, this means less on-site time, less travel, and more useful work, and not necessarily relying on the customer to have a remote access solution so you can get to all of them.
Right. No, certainly a good thing. Yes, simplifying it for the resellers, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. This also leaves, there's a lot of questions here around data security and data integrity. Like in Europe, for example, the GDPR is going to really upset this. Having that data stored outside of Europe is going to be a growing concern. So there are some hidden issues here that if you're a European company or other countries around the world are putting in rules to say you can't store this type of data, like especially system administration data. And also security is a big concern. Like we've seen, you know, we've talked a lot about the Equifax hacked. And what we know is big companies don't do security very well. So there is a substantial risk here that somebody could burn down your entire stack just by accessing this cloud platform.
Well, that's always been one of the concerns about people adopting a cloud management layer, but it also hasn't blunted that market any. So people are getting over it.
Yeah. But on the whole, I think this vision of managing an on-premise private cloud from a public cloud, that seems to be a popular way to do things. The Meraki product seems to have a great deal of traction with customers. And I think Cisco's looked at that model and gone, we need to be doing more of that for the enterprise. They've got to be careful not to lose money and give it away to the Meraki people because, you know, the loss of features and loss of functions could undermine their higher revenue products. But this is looking like a strong vision for them. It's a gradual, incremental. It's not disruptive. It's not an invasion. This is pretty obvious. We've seen Cisco slap a public cloud management layer on top of it. I mean, people don't want to buy their Prime or their ACI because it is pretty grim product to run in-house. Cisco hasn't done a good job of packaging that software for customers to use. So making that Cisco's problem, if you want to be a Cisco customer, does actually do have a positive impact, I think.
And that's one of the things they said to me in their briefing is we feel like customers are spending too much time building infrastructure just to manage the infrastructure. And so the idea of this cloud is to take that off their plates and put it on Cisco's plate.
So if I was to decode that, that is customers don't like our software because it's awful and it's so hard to install and to upgrade and to maintain because it's a bunch of Java junk. And, you know, if only we had written it in a modern, you know, modern language and a modern architecture, it might actually work reliably. But aside from that, now it's all Cisco's problem. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Yes. Yeah, that's an interesting reading of that language and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. You know, there's two sides to every coin, right? You can gild the lily on one side, but the other side's still sitting in pond scum.
That's right. All right. Sticking with cloud, starting October 2nd, Amazon has announced that it's going to offer per second billing for EC2 instances and EBS volumes. This per second billing also covers the AWS batch service for batch jobs and AWS EMR, which is Elastic MapReduce. That's a Hadoop framework for data processing. So they've gone from 1 hour charges down to 1 second charges, although you have to start with a 1 minute minimum charge to get this. But 1 second pricing, that's an interesting development in this whole public cloud space.
Yeah, I think so. Google's been doing something like this. I think they've been charging per minute. And so taking it down to a second is a bit of a nah.
There's a little bit of that, oh yeah, kind of,
I can go, hold my beer kind of thing.
Yes.
I do think that, you know, it does move it from 1 hour to 1 second. And I forgot an idea that Google was charging 1 minute intervals, which was a substantial advantage for people who were doing batch scripts. And if the batch script runs for 15 minutes and then finishes, you've still got to pay for the whole instance charge for an hour. So it does work out to be a price reduction for some use cases, but for other people, it's probably just going to be a problem. Some people were writing and saying, yeah, no, this means I can do 60 seconds of some sort of massive compute job on 10,000 instances. And I thought to myself, well, provided that you've got all the time and the energy and the skill to automate the setup and tear down of 10,000 EC2 instances,
right,
plus configure all the networking and the security, Sure, you might have a $10 run on AWS if you spent $10,000 automating the setup.
Uh-huh, right.
So just, to get, it's like the old story, email's free, provided you've bought a $1,000 computer or an $800 smartphone.
Exactly. Yes, I think this seems like, again, Amazon trying to introduce more competitive differentiation to Azure and Google Cloud Compute. And also, there's probably limited use cases at this point for 1 second billing. I can see some use cases where people go, great, I'm going to cut down my bill here. But yes, there's also going to be some back end work to actually take advantage of orchestrating your data processing to actually be that precise.
Yes, and I think the key here is that Intel's been putting much better telemetry in its CPUs. So this system probably triggers off some Intel technology that allows you to monitor the compute consumption per second. So this is actually not a software feature. It's a hardware feature that enables the telemetry. When we went to Intel's IDF conference in 2016, we saw a demo of, I think it's called Spark. Can't quite remember. But they showed that you've got, like, there's all this telemetry in the CPU and you can pull all these stats about internal buses on the CPU and how much compute cycles are being burned and all that sort of stuff on very small, like, millisecond intervals. And that's something that Amazon was asking Intel, if I remember the presentation, the cloud providers have been asking for this. So first of all, you had to have the silicon support a specific feature. And then, of course, Amazon had to update its software to take, I imagine that calculating per second billing is a substantial increase of overhead for them.
I shudder to think at the monitoring and tracking systems they've got to do to actually enable this. It must be a lot of work for them. All right, let's take a quick break to tell you about ExtraHop. They are the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wired data. That's the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment, from the data center to the edge to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. For too long, IT has thought of the network as either just the plumbing or a problem. But with ExtraHop, the network becomes the biggest source of real-time visibility for IT. That's because ExtraHop does the analysis first and then stores packets, and that creates wired data, which encompasses all the interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective, and analyzing it at scale transforms the network from a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. With ExtraHop, companies like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, McKesson, Netflix, and Expedia save millions of dollars and thousands of hours, improving application response times by more than 70% and mean time to resolution by up to 90%. So if you want to learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself, visit them at extrahop.com/demo. You can connect with them on Twitter as @ExtraHop. And if you mention Packet Pushers, you'll get a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT. Back to the news, Google is spending $1.1 billion to acquire intellectual property and some engineering talent from HTC, that's the Taiwanese smartphone maker.
Yeah, so this looks like a fairly interesting move from Google to sort of take control of its hardware supply chain. We've seen Apple doing a lot of this over the recent times, where it actually owns the CPUs and owns all of the data cycles and all that sort of stuff. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what Google does with this. Now, of course, it's been producing the Pixel phone. HTC is rumored to have been going into bankruptcy or getting away from some of the stuff that it's been doing. So, yes, very interesting, I think, especially if you're a smartphone person, but for a networking person or an infrastructure person, probably not that relevant.
Yeah, it seems like HTC needed to do something. They have less than 1% of the smartphone market, as does Google. So for Google, maybe there's a growth opportunity here. And I also think if Google maybe, apparently they're getting about approximately 2,000 engineers. So it's not just smartphones I think they're going to be focusing on. We're seeing the rise in, like Amazon and Apple having these home automation systems. You've got IoT, you've got virtual reality, augmented reality hardware coming out. I think Google wants to be part of that. And so they may be turning some of these engineers onto sort of moonshot projects aside from just smartphones.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's just this situation where Google wants to is looking at Apple. Apple's got control of its hardware chain. That gives Apple a competitive edge. Like we saw the Apple iPhone 8 announced this week, and I don't want to degrade into an iPhone smartphone. There's plenty of air compression. But, you know, Apple's made their iPhone two or three generations ahead of what its competitors can do in terms of performance. Like they're talking it's as fast as a MacBook that you get today. So if you run certain statistics on it, it's actually as fast, which is, well, astonishing, really. You know?
Yes, it is quite a feat.
So if you own the hardware, then there's certain, you know, and you're in a big enough scaled up market and, you know, whatever. I'm not suggesting that IT vendors, for example, are ever going to do this. They just don't have the size of Apple to justify. Like we saw Apple talking about getting into Toshiba, buying the Toshiba memory business so they can get control of the memory supply chain. But I don't think Google wants to own a supply chain, but it has no choice. It needs to produce the Google Pixel so that other Android makers can be encouraged to take the product in a particular direction. If you want to run an open source project like Android, you have to produce a reference platform to say this is where it's going to go. So that's where I think they're doing it.
Okay, that's interesting. You think part of the strategy is rather than sort of necessarily competing with Samsung and others who are actually making the devices that Android runs on, they're saying, look, we're going to build this phone and we're going to show you how we think you guys should be doing it and spur yes. a little competitive advancement of the platform.
Yeah, like the Android stuff is a long way behind. They recently did some stuff with the Android. I think I remember reading that Android is no longer open source. You have to take the Google version that Google gives you. You can't hack the kernel. They're tightening it up so that you can't just, you know, like Samsung puts its stuff on top and tries to make it not look like Android. Well, Google's saying, no, 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 there has to be a consistent Android experience. And so one way for it to do that is to produce a high-end phone. Really, there's only one now, as I understand. I'm not an Android person, so don't listen to me for advice on smartphones. The Samsung Note 8, I believe, is sort of the current pick of the crop, and the Google Pixel. A lot of people like the Pixel because it doesn't have the Samsung glamour attached to it, if mm-hmm. you want to call it mm-hmm. glamour. People call it crapware, you know, whatever. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that Samsung jams in there that people don't really much like. So Google produces like the Google Pixel, which is like a pure function. So spending $1 billion for them to own that's probably worthwhile.
Certainly.
I guess. Well, that's what they think. What do I know?
They've got the money. All right, moving on to Toshiba. They have finally pulled the trigger on the sale of their NAND memory business. It's going to Bain Capital. That's a private equity firm for about $18 billion. And technically, it's not going to Bain. The company set up a wholly owned company called KK Pangea. It's been formed by Bain and other partners to actually acquire this Toshiba asset. There are, however, issues because the deal could be blocked by ongoing litigation from Western Digital, which was also in the running to acquire the business.
Yeah, so the consortium, I believe, includes like Apple stumped up $3 billion.
Apple's in there. There's a South Korean chip company in there. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of them.
And some Japanese banks. Yep, everybody getting in on it.
So I don't think it's a straightforward to exactly what, and Bain's basically just financed the deal and no doubt making money on both sides, advising companies to invest and advising companies to sell and blah, blah, blah. And Western Digital, of course, is saying that it had a right to buy the business. So we'll see how it works out. The reason that Western Digital wants to fight this is that RAM prices are going up due to restricted supply. Apparently, it's getting harder and harder to make these memory modules or something went wrong. There's some reason why DRAM supply is short at the moment. And so a lot of these companies are getting in here to try and get control of the supply chain. That's what Apple's doing it for. And other companies are looking at it because all of a sudden DRAM pricing is going up. Well, hey, that might be a good business to get into.
Mm-hmm. It certainly seems better than the Westinghouse business that Toshiba got into, which is the reason it's starting to crater.
Nuclear power, like in the UK here, they're investing, if you want to call it investing, I call it wasting money in building some nuclear power plants over here. The price of solar energy is dropping so fast. So sure, we do need some sort of baseload generation, but they're already moving the commissioning date back of these reactors by 5 years. So they're moving them back from 2022 to 2027. And the price is basically rising at about 10% per annum. So it's like ITIL all over again, just at billion-dollar scale. It really is. Like, okay. Oh, well, that wasn't in the contract. We'll have to charge you extra for that. It's like,
and so the world turns.
Oh, and the reactor designs are unproven. Nobody's actually had a working one yet because it takes 10 years to build them. So it's just a design and, oh, gosh.
Well, good luck with that. All right, sticking with deal talk, Reuters is reporting that T-Mobile and Sprint may be close to a deal to merge the two wireless carriers to better compete against Verizon and AT&T here in the U.S. According to Reuters, T-Mobile's owner, Deutsche Telekom, would be the majority shareholder, and Japan's SoftBank, which controls Sprint, would also get a large stake.
I can't see how this is good for the US telecommunications market. This doesn't make sense to me. In the UK, they converged the suppliers down to three, and then the prices just went up. It didn't actually get cheaper, and it didn't get better.
Yeah, yeah. That is my concern here as well. Right now, I feel like T-Mobile is working very hard and aggressively in our market to differentiate itself with pricing and bandwidth options and all-you-can-eat kind of packaging. And if they merge with Sprint and suddenly become sort of a number three gorilla, then I agree that incentive kind of goes away. What they'll focus on is cutting costs and essentially trying to achieve some kind of pricing parity with their competitors, and that's not good for us.
Yeah. So they'll bring their pricing up to Verizon and AT&T, and they won't come down. You wouldn't make sense to, you know, discount against Verizon and AT&T. You make sense to bring your prices up to Verizon's and AT&T and take the profits.
Exactly.
So, you know, we'll see how it works out over time. I think the real issue here is that the government in the US needs to look carefully at the mobile market and intervene to make it competitive and price effective, because it's not. Everything I know about the US mobile market just says that it's an absolute rot. But Verizon and AT&T are just making out like bandits. Like, you're paying three times what I pay, and I'm getting unlimited bandwidth, unlimited calls, and unlimited texts. And I mean unlimited bandwidth in not only in the UK, but in Europe and the US.
But we have freedom here.
Yeah.
That's what we get.
Well, someone's got freedom, but it sounds like it might be Verizon and AT&T.
Yes. Freedom to gouge. That's what they have.
They got a bigger slice of that freedom. So, you know, there are ways to make a market more competitive and to encourage companies to, you know, still be capitalists, but also control them within certain bounds. And for these sorts of businesses, which are fundamental to the market, I am very much a socialist capitalist, which is big companies need to be controlled from their worst
impulses. Yes.
Yeah. But with the current political climate in the US, I doubt that that's going to happen. So this is a great time for T-Mobile and Sprint in terms of businesses. They've wanted to merge for a long period of time. The Competition Commission over there isn't going to block them with the current political climate.
That's the thing I've heard, that they tried to do this 3 years ago and the regulatory agency kicked up a lot of dust and that sort of put the kibosh on it. But there is a new administration in power now that seems to be more business friendly. And so that's giving this deal, I think it's brought it back from the dead. So
yeah,
again, we'll see what happens. Whether or not we get any real regulatory pushback, we'll see. But it's now back on the table. All right, another quick break to tell you about our other sponsor, ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. And that's a huge problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. That's the corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider networks, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. And how can they help? They can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root causes of problems like device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, and so on. And you can share data and insights with your vendors and customers to resolve problems faster. And there's a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/Packet Pushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see. Once more back to the news and to Equifax, this is the story that just keeps on giving. First, Bloomberg reported that Equifax discovered a security breach in March 2017, which is 4 months earlier than the July breach that it reported 3 weeks ago. Equifax says this March intrusion isn't related to the later hack that exposed millions of consumer records, though it may have been perpetrated by the same group. So, wow, just more bad news out of Equifax.
Yeah, I've got a blog post on this, which is sort of drawing it all together. But this is, everything points to Equifax being incompetent around their IT security at every level. They didn't protect what they had. They didn't make obvious patches to what was a public-facing system. And the fact that it starts to look systemic in the sense that they were intruded, you know, there was a breach in March. They didn't go and tell anybody about it. There was a vulnerability in a key piece of software that they must know about, and they didn't do anything about that. Even when the breach, you know, the main breach took place, they took so much data and nobody noticed. Like 143 million records stolen, including a wide range of, you know, that's a substantial size. And they didn't notice that either.
Even if that was part of your regular business, extracting that much data would... Somebody would see that. It's just, it boggles the mind that that kind of exfiltration just went on for so long without anybody going, hey, what's happening there?
Well, if you are running a business which is basically a surveillance company, so they basically surveil every citizen in the US and call it credit
monitoring.
Credit monitoring. So it's actually a surveillance business. You would think they would have, you know, do everything they can to secure their surveillance business in the same way that any, you know, surveillance company like NSA or GCHQ or, you know, Australia's DOD, those organizations go to extreme lengths to keep themselves secret and protected. And yet these corporate companies seem to have like laughable levels of security. And of course, last week we saw the CIO and the CSO retired.
Yes.
With immediate effect. So guess who's taking the fall? I'm sure they got a lovely handshake as they left with a big fat check in it. You know, just the comedy of errors that comes from this organization is just hysterical.
Well, speaking of comedy of errors, the second part of the story is that Equifax mistakenly directed consumers to a fake information site. There were several Equifax tweets that went out that told consumers they could sign up for free credit protection. It sent them to a URL that was actually a fake URL set up by a software engineer to criticize Equifax terrible security practices. So it's just another.
Yeah, there was a lot of hoo-ha this week about the CSO, the chief security officer, being a music major.
Yes, there was.
You know, the reason that that was a big issue, by the way, is because there was nothing else about her history available online. And the same thing about the CIO. So it looks like they actually hired somebody to scrub their public presence on the internet.
Right. Yeah. People went to look at their LinkedIn profiles and all that was there was that this person was a music major.
So all of a sudden you've got this person in charge of a, you know, critical piece of national infrastructure that does surveillance on all of the citizens of a country for money. And the person in charge, the only thing you can see about them is that they have a music, you know, majored in music at, you know, what was fundamentally a high school or a university or something. Now, that's not necessarily a sign, but given the lack of competency at every other step, you would have to say you want to draw a fairly solid conclusion to say this person shouldn't have been in charge.
Yeah, we don't want to discount the fact that just because your college major doesn't disqualify you from being any kind of security expert. It all depends on the kind of experience and things that you've done in your career since college. So that's not a disqualifying fact. What is the disqualifying fact is the abysmal security record at Equifax.
Yeah, you know, based on the evidence, these people show every signs of being fundamentally incompetent.
Yeah,
at every level, not just in terms of having it or responding. You know, once the breach occurred, they responded badly. They didn't go public. They've hidden stuff in the past that's been repeatedly breached. They've done nothing about it. You know, so on and so on and so on. And even their reaction to it, their public reaction is, they built a website. And somebody registered a separate name just to keep it safe. And then they started linking to the dummy site that somebody set up. And I like, you know, that's just like fundamental incompetence in like every dimension.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the company CIO and CSO have both quote unquote retired. For some inexplicable reason, the CEO, Rick Smith, still has a job.
Well, you know, we'll see.
He's going to get away with it. I really do. I have no confidence that he's going to take any responsibility for this.
Let's just take a deviation here. What we're also seeing this week is Facebook had to take a lot of its Russian data and give it to the government because the government demanded it. Now, that's something that Facebook has fought against for a decade. They've flatly refused to give data to the government, and they've buckled under and coughed it up. And what we're now seeing is that the UK government is now running legislation through Parliament to force Facebook to make data available to the police forces on request. The European government is heading down the same path. We're seeing the same thing happen in Australia. Their problem isn't that they just want to say, Facebook, give us all the data. They want to be able to go to the judge and say, we need information or data from this person. And, you know, we need to execute a search warrant on this person's Facebook account, hand over the data. And Facebook's been fighting that for year after year after year. And I think we're starting to see the political system fight against them. And these tech companies are starting to lose their ability to sit outside the law, or to be off the radar would actually be a better thing. Does that make sense?
It does, yes.
So, for example, this morning, the London Transport for London, which is the government, it's a semi-government arm that runs the whole of transport for London. It manages the taxis and the underground and the buses and all that sort of stuff. They've decided that Uber is no longer a fit company to run a taxi service in London, and the license will be rescinded in 8 days.
Mm-hmm. I saw that headline, yes.
So in theory, Uber is out of business in London in 8 days.
For now, yes. I'm sure they can appeal, but...
Because they are not delivering information back to the government that they're not supposed to validate that these people are safe drivers. There's a whole bunch of rules around this stuff. They're not able to validate that the people who are driving for Uber are actually proof citizens, that they're paying tax, they're not providing healthcare or monitoring employee well-being and so forth and so on. And these are all things that other taxi companies have to do. So on one side, Uber is a fine business and it's often a better experience for the customer. But then we also have a situation where multiple press reports in London show that Uber drivers have a higher incidence of rape and theft and criminal activity than old taxis do. So it's not all roses and donuts, you know. So we're going to see something really interesting here. There's really brewing to be a social backlash against all of the technology companies, and I think Equifax might get caught up in that. And people are going to start to say, well, like, you are critical infrastructure. You have to act at the same level as an electricity company or a nuclear company, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If Equifax is breached, then all of a sudden the issuing of credit becomes a severe risk.
Right.
So what we saw this week is, just to show you how bad things are in this credit monitoring business, Experian published a website which asked for a bunch of personal details, the exact details that were stolen from Equifax. And once you go in there, it emails you a PIN number so you can unfreeze your credit. So if I was a criminal activity, I could now go in, unfreeze your credit, and start signing up credit in your name with the data from Equifax on the Experian site.
So you're saying if I, as a consumer, go and freeze my credit at Experian, an attacker who's stolen data from Equifax can use that data to unfreeze my credit and then take advantage of it.
Exactly. They're asking questions like, what's your SSN, what's your address, what's your date of birth, and what's your email address? Well, that's all the stuff that's in Equifax, right? It's not, you know, and then they'll email you a PIN number so that you can unlock your credit. It's like, really? Didn't you not think this through? So there's some pretty flawed thinking going on in this part of the financial industry. This is not something that banks would do because, you know, they have rules.
Ugh.
Anyway.
Wow. All right. I'm going to have to go look at that and then go bang my head against a wall for half an hour.
No, don't look at it. Just let it slide. let's wait for Facebook to get its comeuppance, because it's going to be sweet.
Okay. I'm very curious about this. I agree there is a backlash, part government, part consumer, about the power that technology companies are having over our lives. It's going to be interesting to see how this fight plays out, because these technology companies also have a lot of political and financial influence, and they will deploy that as hard and fast as they can to preserve their power.
Well, one of the interesting things about this, of course, is that companies like Amazon and Facebook pay very little tax. So they actually have very little influence with the government.
No. They have very – well, no. The influence they have comes through lobbying. That's where they have influence.
Yes, but at the end of the day, they don't pay a lot of tax. So you can have companies like Walmart, who's paid 14 times as much tax last year as Amazon, who can actually go to the government and say, well, you know, look, we pay taxes, Amazon doesn't. Who are you going to talk to? And people are starting to realize that a lot of these companies have grown on the back of zero tax or very dodgy taxation practices, Apple, you know, all of them. And the governments are going like, why should I cut you a special deal if you're not paying tax? And so that's coming apart.
Right? That's right. And I love the complaint that, well, it would be impossible for us to figure out how to calculate state tax for all these states that we work in. Like, okay, you can monitor per second usage of your CPUs, but you can't calculate 50 state taxes. Okay, right.
Yeah, sure.
That's a good
idea. Sure.
Anyway, okay, off the soapbox. Our last news story. HP is reportedly planning to cut 5,000 jobs, or about 10% of its staff, according to Bloomberg. Cuts could come before the end of the year.
Yeah, I don't think this is a real problem. I still think HPE is a bit bloated. And keep in mind that they've made a number of acquisitions this year. They bought Nimble Storage, CloudCUSA, Simplivity, Rasa Networks, and there's a couple of others that are TPE Cloud Partners as well.
Right, the consulting firm, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not like they're getting smaller per se, but they are certainly cutting some of the areas of the company that aren't performing very well. Keep in mind that Cisco cuts 10,000 headcount every year.
Fairly regularly, yeah. They do a big...
Fairly regularly, right, which is about 10% of its staff. So this is HPE roughly moving down the same lines. I don't think this is the end of the world. But the chief financial officer has said that the company is targeting $1.5 billion in savings over a three-year period. Well, hey, that's real money.
That is real money. All right, well, I hope they do it before the holidays at least. That would be a very awful holiday present.
Good luck to all the people we know at HPE. I hope you survive, if that's what you want.
That's right.
And if that's not what you want, I hope you get to leave and go and do something better with your time. You know, have an upgrade.
That's right. It's an opportunity.
Yes, as startups would say, you can graduate to something better.
Oh. All right, well, that wraps up this episode. Greg, how can people get social with you?
You can find me on the Twitter is @EtherealMind, where I'm just full of fun and joy. But I'm also powering up the snark factor on my personal Twitter account, which is @GregJFerro. Lots of people follow me there, but that's where I really just unlock the hinge, a little rude, and fairly blunt sort of stuff, and having a great time. That really fills the inner Greg, I think.
Okay, if you need Greg uncut, then you know where to go. I'm full of fun and joy on Twitter at Drew_CM. I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, Extra Hop and Thousand Eyes, and thank you for listening to this episode of Network Break. If you like it, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share it with your friends. And we've got a new membership option that gets you the link propagation and human infrastructure newsletters for free. You can sign up at packetpushers.net/members. Thanks for listening.